Hello, this is Guillermo del Toro, and you're listening to Out Now Podcast. Hello.
Now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and Abe is not here. He's too much of a scaredy cat for these bonus horror episodes that we've been doing. As you might recall, we have these special horror bonuses that we're doing all through the month of October. This year, we are focusing on specific horror filmmakers, and this week, we are discussing John Carpenter. That's the plan here. We, of course, have our regular show, and this is our bonus show, all film related all the time. And to join me to discuss John Carpenter this week, as always, for these bonus horror episodes, we have from JoeBlow.com, Jimmy O.
Now, wait, are you saying we're doing a horror episode? I think I've got the wrong episode. I thought we were doing horror.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you said horror. John Carpenter's not a horror. How dare you? Thank you. Yes. Welcome. It's another week. Welcome back.
from starpulse.com, Jason Coleman.
Telling it like it is. Absolutely. And you know what? I do think, Abe, you know, at the very least, fans should write in. You know, I know you get people who write comments and things like that on your podcast here. I think we should all band together and have Abe show up for the very last one of these. I'd love to see him come and join us for the last one. And I'm happy to be here.
Great. Yeah. Well, yes, I would like to get Abe on here. I want my Abe right now, so let's get that campaign going. Hashtag, I want my Abe on here. It's nice. A long hashtag.
And that last, is a long hashtag.
lastly, from Why So Blue and the Naptown Nerd, it's Brandon Peters.
I came here to chew bubblegum and talk about John Carpenter, and I'm all out of gum.
All right.
Nice. Was that the boogeyman?
As a matter of fact, that was.
Thank you. I was waiting for that, so goddamn time.
Okay, that's enough of that. We're talking about John Carpenter, damn it. That's the plan here. I've got you guys together. We're going to go with this. Last week we did Wes Craven. That was a lot of fun, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Good. Okay. Well, now we have John Carpenter, another huge staple in all of horror filmdom. John Carpenter, what was his last movie? The Ward? Was that it?
The Ward.
Yep.
Yeah.
Out of having not directed a feature film for 9 years and chose The Ward?
Yeah.
Yeah, leaving us off with Ghosts of Mars wasn't exactly a strong finish either for before The Ward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get to that period.
Yeah, we'll start off with
the farther back we go, the more amazing the stuff.
Yeah.
Interesting how we have two horror filmmakers in a row who, like, the last several films are like, yeah, they tried.
Like, that, you know what? Unfortunately, that seems like it's almost every horror filmmaker.
Maybe as they get on in the career, you know, maybe the inspiration and that desire and that hunger starts to subside. So,
unfortunately, we have some interesting stuff happening next week, I'd say. So we'll see.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's get into John Carpenter. Right. Last week we tried to kind of get into our overall thoughts on Wes Craven before we kind of got into the films, and I want to do that again with John Carpenter. And I'm gonna start. Brandon, let's start with you. What are your like overall thoughts on Carpenter as a horror filmmaker?
Well, as a filmmaker, period, he is. You know, I have with my favorite filmmakers of all time, it's always Carpenter, Hitchcock, and Kubrick. And, you know, any given day, Carpenter made my favorite film of all time, which is Halloween. And, you know, he's got this style that people now are copying, but it was kind of all to his own. He never made like a hugely, at its time, like impactful, high-grossing box office smash. I mean, there was Halloween. Starman, yeah. But if you look at the grosses of all his films, they're not massive. I mean, he never had ones going over $30 million. Even
they're generally disappointments. I mean, they're generally disappointments. Really no other way to say it.
That later on, come down the line, that people finally turn around and respect. He's got a touch, you know, even good and bad, you can tell John Carpenter did the film. But yeah, well, I mean, we'll get into it more, but yeah, he's very important filmmaker to me. Watching his films taught me a lot about filmmaking, and a lot of his techniques and stuff made me feel like I was a person that I could do it myself. I had it in me to do it myself too, you know.
Mm.
Well, Jimmy, how about you? What are your thoughts on John Carpenter?
I mean, he was a huge inspiration. Halloween is still, to this day, one of the most important movies for me, in so many ways. Just it was one of the first horror films I'd ever seen. It scared the living crap out of me. I almost said the F word. It inspired me because I saw what a filmmaker could do. Yeah, how he could terrify an audience, and I thought that was beautiful. And I just, I don't know, he made me aware of how important horror can be and how much fun it can be.
Jason?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'd be remiss not to start by saying, you know, Big Trouble in Little China. You know, I named my kid after the lead character in Big Trouble in Little China, the great Jack Burton. So I am a huge, huge Carpenter fan. And I think for me, one of the things that's great about Carpenter is he does have a signature style. So, I could put the movie in front of you and you would know it was a John Carpenter film. And that's not to say that he does the same thing, you know, because if you look at his body of work, I mean, there's eclecticism in his work. You know, obviously horror he's really good at, but when he touched upon other things, his signature style was still there. But mm-hmm. he was able to still grasp onto, you know, more fantasy or things of that nature, action, whatever. So, but I think above all else, you know, and including, you know, great music that he would compose himself, which I think added to the style and allure of his movies, was that the most important thing was that John Carpenter is a great storyteller.
I very much agree. And where I felt like the kind of the negative voice last week when it came in regards to Wes Craven.
Oh, yeah, you hate Wes Craven. I forgot.
That's not true, and nor should that be a hashtag.
You hate... hashtag Aaron hates Wes Craven.
Wow, Aaron hates Wes. Wow.
Wes Craven, yeah. He made films.
Wow.
Well, while I've had issues with Wes Craven as a filmmaker, despite very much admiring what the man gave to the horror genre, John Carpenter is a person who... There are certainly films that are lesser from him, but he, as a filmmaker, I think is terrific. I think he's one of those filmmakers where you can watch a film of his not knowing it's him and pretty much deduce that he's the man behind the camera, which is something that not many filmmakers are able to accomplish. He has a very deliberate sense of style that's evident in all of his films. You guys have pointed out a lot of the things about it already, but it's something that I certainly admire and... He has several films that are some of my favorites, so certainly some of my favorite horror films. And yes, like you guys have said also, that he's branched out beyond just horror. He's done sci-fi and he's done some comedies, quote unquote, but and, you know, just kind of action movies. And he has this kind of sense of purpose in his films that I generally admire. I love the kind of the way he casts his characters, his kind of deliberate pacing, which very much recalls a kind of Western style, which it's still a little insane that he hasn't made a Western. No, there's just, I have just lots of praise for John Carpenter as a filmmaker. I wish that I could see, you know, better films from him in these kind of the later years of his career, but we'll go through that.
The guy from Assault on Precinct 13 to They Live has one of the most amazing runs of films for any filmmaker for sure. For that mm-hmm. long a stretch. It's incredible.
And listen, someone that visionary, I'm not surprised that some of these movies weren't huge hits. I think you know, in a lot of the cases of these movies that we're going to go through, you're going to say it's ahead of its time. People didn't know what they were seeing, didn't appreciate it. And that was the same with a lot of his work. I think he was heads and tails above what was being done, and people were kind of stunned. At least those of us who knew great film weren't stunned, but those, you know, the masses were kind of, you know, didn't really get it and then got it later. So way ahead of his time.
Why was Christine not a bigger hit?
I have no idea.
Like, that's yeah. It was Steven, at the height of the king in the theater stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if that just seems like a slam dunk, right? He's got a Stephen King film. John Carpenter's behind it. He's coming off The Thing. But
The Thing wasn't even when it first came out.
No, it wasn't a hit at all. But
it wasn't a hit at all.
I don't even think it got really well good remarks from critics at that time.
No,
Ebert hated it, but Ebert with 80s horror we have to just kind of throw away because he was out. That's his weakest point of his career because he was out to get everything. He brought back unnecessary censorship, leading the charge. He just hated horror of the 80s.
He hated the evolution into kind of the explicit content, I guess.
Effects driven, you know, like using younger character. Like he didn't get it. Like at all, but
which
I mean,
it's interesting because he's a huge champion of Halloween. Like
he's a huge champion of Halloween, but when right. Friday the 13th does the same thing, he hates it. So it's we got to throw his opinion in the 80s, him and Siskel in the 80s out because they just weren't. They were guys who it was not material made for them per se. They were out of touch with what it was, and they just were angry adults. They made me want to see these films more because of how nasty they thought they were. Look up if people want to look up some hilarity, look up their review for Friday the 13th, the final chapter. I know we're off topic here, but just a funny thing. Look at that and look how ludicrous they come off. Back to John Carpenter.
Yeah, I mean, talking about kind of well, you brought up kind of their Ebert's influence on the kind of the culture of the time of kind of bringing up necessary censorship. Let's talk about John Carpenter, what he's kind of brought to filmdom in general.
He was a USC film geek guy, but not one of the, like, higher known ones like the Coppola and George Lucas and Spielberg.
Mm.
He came out of USC and was, I mean, he's of that crowd, but I don't think he gets thrown in with them very often.
He dropped out.
Yeah.
He seemed like, again, from the body of work, it really does seem like he was kind of a risk taker. You know, he was like, I don't want to, you know, just do the same shit all the time. Because you could easily just run Halloween-esque kind of films and just keep doing that and going, well, that was the success. We're going to just keep doing that. But he branched out. He told stories. So it's an impressive body of work.
Well, holding on to, you know, generally the same tone. Like, it's, regardless of the film, you can... It comes down to his pacing, like what he does in film and like how he kind of stages things. Where I look at something like Halloween or The Fog or Escape from New York, and you can kind of see the progressions very much the same in each of these films as they kind of ratchet up the tension throughout. Even Assault on Precinct 13 is another. I mean, a lot of his films are.
I love that movie.
Examples.
Yeah, there's there's an interesting slowness, mm-hmm. and that where you're talking about ratcheting up the tension in Assault on Precinct.
Prince of Darkness might be the pinnacle of this.
Yeah.
Oh, I think Prince of Darkness. I mean, I feel like we're really jumping ahead. And I guess we'll get.
I don't want
to
get into
later.
The film.
Yeah, but God, I love that movie.
Yeah, I think that's his most underappreciated one. Possibly is Prince of Darkness.
What's interesting is I remember hearing on the commentary for Assault on Precinct 13 years later, where he was sort of saying, "Oh, I would speed this up now," and I don't think he understood exactly how brilliant his pacing. You know, if that was his thought, how brilliant his pacing was, because the same thing when you talk about Prince of Darkness, there's a real slow sense of menace that kind of permeates the movies, and that I think he didn't understand how great it was. It is. It's awesome.
Yeah, but a director is his worst critic of his own work. I mean, they don't like to watch their own movies. A lot of them, they don't think. I mean, they'll say stuff that they don't realize that we like that stuff because there's a was it Lustig did Maniac Cop 2, and a lot of people praised that for its effects work and its stunt work. And I saw like a Q&A with him where he was apologizing for the old effects and stuff like that. People were like, no, we like that. So, I mean, you never know what the old guy thinks of his film.
Right.
You can see how he's obviously, you know, influenced other filmmakers since him, too. I mean, I think Robert Rodriguez in particular is one who's kind of taken a lot of cues from Carpenter over time. You can see that, especially in, like, Planet Terror specifically. That's always one that sticks out to me. It's right. Like, he's basically...
Well, they set out to make the Lost Carpenter film was their goal.
Mm-hmm.
Terror. I think Adam Wingard's shown a lot of
yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
You can watch. Yeah. I mean, you watch The Guest in that.
The Guest, yeah,
it's, yeah. It's
such a clear.
James Cameron with The Terminator. That's clearly Carpenter influenced.
And Cameron, of course, is famously worked on Escape from New York.
Escape from New York, right?
Well, that yeah, it is funny because the future in The Terminator kind of resembles the New York from Escape from New York, which he painted that future. So, give or take, who's it? Belongs to.
You can very much see that, yeah, for sure. Even in like the scoring of the Terminator, it feels simple enough where it could be Carpenter-esque.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. And it's interesting, by the way, that you're talking, you know, music and style, and in that, that's another one of those staples where you're saying, oh, I could know a Carpenter movie. They're completely different, you know, tones to each of the scores, but all equally really good. And it's amazing that somebody with, a strong visual and storytelling sense could come up with great music that accompanies it that you could just listen to, and it just brings you. I can listen to, a score album of one of his films, and it brings me right back into that movie.
Yeah, he's got the advantage that, I can't think of many other filmmakers, but he scores most of his films. So when he's filming, he knows how the music goes with it. He knows, he could visualize that perfectly as he's going along, because he's also scoring it in his head as he films it.
Something else that we should get into, Carpenter, he's not a studio guy, right? Like
he hits it every once in a blue moon, but yeah, he pretty much likes to my way or the highway.
Yeah, I think that's what may have kept him sort of, out of that main hue, which is good, though, because, maybe his films wouldn't have been so, so risque, so to speak. But he comes across then, now, all the time, like somebody who's like, this is my movie, my name's above the title, and it's my film. So thank God, because some of these movies are just, maybe things that they want to change or whatever. He didn't want that. And so I think it's a good thing. The only, one of the times, though, of course, was the same thing as Wes during that 80s time where Universal was teaming up with Shep Gordon. So that was the time of They Live and Prince of Darkness. So that was one of the, that kind of offshoot Universal thing. But other than that, yeah.
But they still very much feel like Carpenter movies.
Right? Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or something like The Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Wow, yeah. Oh. Yeah, that was Warner Brothers, yeah.
Yeah.
One thing with Carpenter I've always found that seems signature with him that I like is he always has these movies that have big ideas that make a huge impact on you as an audience member, but by telling like low budget stories or low budget movies with the most intimate stories, but they have like a huge impact and they have big ideas, but you're not massive. If that makes any sense, like the stories are intimate.
No, like very much for sure. I mean, you have,
He's sneakily good at world building.
He is, for sure. I mean, you mentioned Escape from New York and how Terminator's world almost feels like something out of that, because you get a sense of what the future is like in Escape from New York and, by extension, Escape from L.A.
Without over-focusing on anything, you're focused on an intimate story within that world, and you just kind of learn naturally with things, and your own curiosity follows it rather than over stuffing details.
Each of the characters is interesting and helps create that world. So in Escape, same thing in Escape from New York. Each of those characters brings kind of a uniqueness, from Ernest Borgnine to Harry Dean Stanton. Every character helps build the world. Even you're the great Isaac Hayes as the governor.
Haddonfield, Illinois. I mean, you feel like you know that place.
Oh yeah. God, yeah.
Which absolutely is very much like, I think, on purpose. It's a classic suburban feel to that town that's clearly established as such, as that, so it could be anywhere, which adds to the tension of that film, because you feel like you could be easily among the victims of Michael Myers, because you're just like, oh, this is just like any old town at a time when you didn't see movies like that frequently. All right, well, let's move into the films. I mean, it's like we're trying not to talk specifically about things. So let's get right to the beginning here with Assault on Precinct 13.
Right. Great. And you made an interesting point, Aaron, earlier about I think it was you when you talked about the Western. Mm-hmm. This is the classic. Obviously that theme comes up later in other movies, but this is the classic Western.
We're not talking Dark Star.
Yeah. My You're school right. buddy, you could walk over at USC and get Dan O'Bannon to do a movie with you.
Yeah, see, there you go. Like,
that was the 70s USC, man.
Yeah,
everybody was the next great.
Love that movie.
If anything, Dark Star definitely, I think, solidified maybe sci-fi love for Carpenter. Which you ended up seeing later on in his work.
Absolutely,
for sure. It's neat. Like Dark Star, like, I'm not a huge fan of Dark Star, honestly. Like, I appreciate it for what it is. It's just, every time I try to watch it, it's like, yeah, it just doesn't do much for me.
# Aaron hates Dark Star.
Wow.
I like that other film that Dan O'Bannon was a part of. What's it called?
Return of the Living Dead?
No, no. Alien. I think that one did it pretty well. I think.
that one's okay.
Yeah. Dark Star and Elm Street, The Movies I Don't Like by Aaron Neuwirth.
Yep. And anything by Wes Craven.
Sure, he made movies.
Do you have more to say about Dark Star? Are there other juicy details you want to get into about this movie?
No, oh, wow. We're good.
Okay, so back to Assault on Precinct 13.
So yeah, definitely a Western, definitely a siege picture.
Rio Bravo.
Yeah, Rio Bravo. But that's the interesting thing because you know today we kind of go, well, remakes, you know, really suck. You know, we should go with the originals, and then people go, well, wait a minute, you know, Assault on Precinct 13, The Thing, these are remakes, but you know, it didn't feel like a remake because he made it his own. And I think that's the key that a lot of movies aren't doing, you know, that are being remade. They're not making it their own. If you're going to take it, make it your own, man. And Assault on Precinct 13 is absolutely his.
Yes. Well, no, I think it's, I mean, it also, he claims Night of the Living Dead inspired it as well, because if you take the gang and change it with zombies, that's close to what you got, too.
It very much absolutely. Is. And it works well, because you have just characters that are stuck in a situation, much like Night of the Living Dead. And
he shoots a little girl in the movie. Yeah, ballsy. Yeah.
It was very, yeah, that was, this movie is still, I think it still holds up today. I mean, it's obviously dated, but there's something about it. It's kind of like those, like, Last House on the Left and that Hills Have Eyes from Wes Craven. It just feels so raw and dirty and awesome. It's just so cool. It's amazing to watch today.
And with you know, Darwin Johnson's, you know, Johnston's Napoleon, that started kind of an interesting thing of the anti-hero, which of course would show up later as well. It was an interesting kind of, you know, the guy who's kind of the scumbag, but at the same time maybe he's a good guy. So love that theme kind of explored in this movie and then later in others.
Yeah, we also get Carpenter regulars Nancy Loomis and Charles Cyphers
on it too.
Their first collabo.
Nancy Keys, originally, as Nancy Loomis. Now she's Nancy Keys. Now it was Nancy Loomis. When did she change her name?
Well, she married Tommy Lee Wallace, and then they had like a divorce, and then she changed her name back.
That's terrible.
Any thoughts on the remake of Assault on Precinct 13?
Terrible movie.
You think it's terrible? Bad. You go terrible on it?
I mean, I'm trying to remember. Do we remember who directed it?
It was.
Do you see what I mean? But see, the fact that we all had to think about that.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of these remakes. I can't think of the name.
Right, but I'm saying to me, there was nothing interesting about that movie. I mean, they took the basic premise and then just like there was no finesse. It was like a steak. It's like a brand name steak. They took another steak. They added no finesse, no seasoning, no sauce, no nothing, and it was just generic crap. And it there was nothing special about it. And again,
that's
how
I like my steak, though.
Yeah,
I don't like any sauce on it. So
I like flavor on my steak. So, but yeah, I don't know, man. It was a rough ride.
I would agree. It has nothing really to kind of say or nothing to really like hark upon in the same way that also the original, you know, kind of, you know, manages to both be this kind of remake of this kind of influenced by Rio Bravo and Night of the Living Dead. But I do think there's, because I kind of like it. Like, it's not one that I've seen since. But I remember walking out thinking, well, that wasn't half bad. Going in thinking, well, why am I going to see an Assault on Precinct 13 remake? It's like, well, they did their thing. But I see exactly what you're saying in terms of, yeah, I mean, it's nothing. There's nothing here besides, like, hey, get these actors together and put them in a room and see how that plays out. But.
Well, there's two different kinds. Listen, there's one. There's a remake where somebody's going, okay, I want to remake this. I want to make it my own. I want to give it, infuse it with originality and interesting, and make it something different. And then there's the remake where people are like, well, we have it as a title in our cachet. Let's just remake it because then we don't have to pay for it.
Yeah, but even for people, it certainly falls into that latter category. But that latter category doesn't always produce. Even if it's just made because, hey, the title worked once, it doesn't mean that the film is necessarily horrible.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like, again, I'm not trying to argue that it's, you know, amazing, and really we don't even need to keep focusing on this movie that much, but...
Hashtag Aaron thinks the remake of Assault on Precinct 13 is freaking brilliant.
Oh, wow.
Jimmy, do you want to get your undying love for someone's watching me?
I do like
Warren Hutton.
I do. I love that. Hey, dude, that TV movie, that was awesome.
It brought Barbeau in to the Carpenter picture.
Barboobs.
His then wife, I believe, right?
Well, no, yes. He was with Deborah Hill for a while, and then he met Adrian Barbeau, and it kind of caused a nasty little bust up, but Hill stuck around.
Yeah, she,
a little bit.
Yeah, she helped produce one of the most successful independent films of all time. She stuck with that.
She's around.
And then, of course, Elvis brought in some Kurt Russell action. So yeah. We gotta be thankful about that. So.
Well, before we get there, let's get to Halloween.
Right.
So, Halloween made for very little money, becomes huge success. Partially because of Ebert, really. Like he really did champion that film enough to kind of get it spread.
Oh, he really did. Yeah,
there were a lot of other critics were not happy with it. They did not enjoy what was going on in this Halloween movie.
I always thought the most fascinating thing about Halloween was that, and I remember reading this on like liner notes on a Laserdisc or something, but that they had screened the movie with no music, and people were like, "This movie's not scary." I mean, I'm sure it had an amazing style and interesting, you know, kind of visuals, and then Carpenter put that score on, and it just scared the crap out of people. And I just thought, wow, what a craftsman that he would not go, "Oh, I have to reshoot this and do that," but he would just add more of his flavor to it, and just took off. And now that theme is like friggin' legendary. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And yeah, the score combined with the dialogue of Dr. Loomis build up Michael and make him so damn scary, because Michael's not really doing, I mean, there's a lot of stalking, but I mean, in between that is Dr. Loomis telling you how bad this dude is.
Yeah, you have no reason to, besides like being unnerved by the fact that there's some guy out there, you have no reason to really think much of him and be, except for the fact that Dr. Loomis is hyping him up for you.
Well, he did kill his sister when he was a kid, so that's pretty bad.
That doesn't. Yeah. Help. Yeah.
That didn't make him more like, you know, it's not, you don't want to bring him home to dad. If you're dating.
It's been 20 years. Like, he's probably okay.
Maybe. But he won't take the mask off.
He got the help he needed, one would think.
Well, clearly not, because he escaped. So. Yeah.
The what's interesting about what you said, Brandon, was the gravitas of Donald Pleasence as an actor. Yeah. I think just hammers that shit home, because you could easily have someone do that dialogue and you're like, eh. But there's authenticity and gravitas and a real authority in the stuff that he says, and that absolutely, I agree with you, gives it just a punch, man.
It also
he took that seriously, man. That is an awesome performance.
It's great, and it started a trend. I mean, if you look at a lot of the slashers, they were like, okay, let's bring back some. More an actor who was notable maybe in the 60s or something that hasn't done anything for a while, and you get like Betsy Palmer in Friday the 13th, you get John Saxon in Elm Street, you get Farley Granger in Prowler, you get
Glenn Ford in Happy Birthday to Me.
That starts a trend of trying to put someone in there.
And Pleasance
it up a little bit.
And Pleasance wasn't even Carpenter's first choice here. He was going for
Christopher Lee
and Peter Cushing, like those boys. He wanted those buddies to try and get in there. But and Lee would go on. He'd be like, I made a bad call on that one. Like he admits that. Like, he openly is like, I should have taken that part. Although if Christopher Lee was in this movie, I feel like it'd be too much of a toe to toe with Michael Myers. I'd be like, he's taller than him.
You know, but, and also Carpenter brings to Halloween. Its look is different than a lot of things. He takes a lot from the Italian filmmakers, like the aesthetic and look of it. And you really get that sense of that when it came to Blu-ray and started looking like it should for the first time. There's sort of like that kind of feel to it. It doesn't look like total giallo, but you can kind of see that in there.
Each of the girls, and I'm sure Jimmy would back me up on this, each of the girls is extremely interesting and unique and thought out, so that when, you know, mayhem does happen, you actually give a crap about
them. They feel like people.
Yeah.
The conversations that they had, like the scene that Deborah Hill wrote, that they're in the car, just feels like two teenage girls having a conversation. And that's the beauty of this. They weren't like nowadays it's like, oh well, you have to have the slutty girl, you have to have whatever, the bitch. Now it's like these are genuine people that you actually just liked.
And, you know, when they go babysitting up until she's killed, this is Annie's movie just as much as it is Laurie's, if not more so. And you have Jamie Lee Curtis is who we kind of follow at the beginning. But knowing that she's Janet Leigh's daughter, you might think they're setting you up for a psycho thing where she gets offed early on. And maybe we're following Annie through the rest of it because she's a more colorful person. She's fun to follow around, and you know Laurie's just kind of being, you know, we're just following the quiet girl around.
She's really hot, by the way.
We didn't know the stereotypes at this time because this is the first slasher. I mean, it's not the first slasher, but it's the first one that just nailed the concept, got it fine, and everybody looks to.
You have to. I hate to kind of burst the bubble, but you have to give credit to what the film that inspired Halloween.
Christmas?
Yeah. Oh my.
I wanted to give credit to that.
But also, Carpenter made a student film called Captain Voyeur, which has a lot of Halloween in it, and it's kind of like a prototype for Halloween. So I can imagine him making that film, and he probably saw Black Christmas and got a bit more ideas, but the idea to do a film like that was always in his head, regardless of what Bob Clark says. And the fact that Carpenter had come up with the name for the title of the film, which Erwin Yablons did, because it was the babysitter murders for most of it. And then Erwin Yablons said, hey, no one's ever called the film Halloween. Let's just call it Halloween. And because Bob Clark will tell the story that some young kid came up to him when Black Christmas was out and said, hey, man, you ever think of a sequel? And he said, no. He's like, if I did a sequel, you know, I'd have the killer come back and he'd stalk the girl on Halloween and call it Halloween. And he tells that story, which I think is a load of crap, honestly.
Probably.
But considering Captain Voyeur exists to prove that, maybe not. But
I don't know. Bob Clark is Canadian, and Canadians are pretty nice. It's hard to...
Not all. I'm from Canada.
But no, Black Christmas is terrific.
Oh, God. Canadians.
So good.
But no, Black Christmas is terrific. And it is the, you know, I guess you could call it first before Halloween. But how many people saw Black Christmas?
I did.
Was it 74 when it came out?
Yeah, it's weird how that movie kind of found a life because of Halloween. Mm-hmm. Years later, I mean, years after, when people started like really dissecting these films, people discovered Black Christmas and they're like, "Oh crap, this is kind of cool. It's kind of like Halloween.
There's like Blood and Black Lace by Mario Bava, which could be considered the start of the slasher film, but you know, Twitch of the Death, or Bay of Blood, Twitch of the Death, or whatever you call it. Also, there's all these things beforehand, but I think they're all just building up to what perfects and becomes Halloween.
Even Texas Chainsaw, you can kind of look at it as a slasher.
Yeah, you could.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Children shouldn't play with dead things. No.
We've done so much Halloween talk over the years on this podcast, and Brandon, you've written... You have about 32 posts concerning Halloween.
I try.
Because it's the best movie ever.
Yeah, I've written so much about Halloween, and then I feel like I'm done, and then something comes up, and I'm writing about Halloween around Halloween again.
Nice.
It's weird.
Well, let's jump into... I know he has a couple TV movies, but honestly, one of my favorite Carpenter movies is The Fog.
Oh, yeah.
Which was his horror follow-up. This is a wonderful, wonderful movie with an amazing cast. And it's still creepy.
It's a Halloween reunion, pretty much.
Yeah,
introduces Tom Atkins to the John Carpenter universe.
And don't let Jamie Lee Curtis drive a car. She can never start the damn car. How dare she? She can't drive. She can't start it. That with Tom Atkins, he would start the car, but no. He gave her the keys.
One factor in Carpenter films that I love in the early stages is his pairing with Dean Cundey. And I think The Fog is one of Cundey's most beautifully shot films.
Oh, agreed, yeah. Well, definitely. Too.
And that guy helped give Carpenter his look a lot. Because it'll carry on past Dean Cundey, where you can still sell as Carpenter. I'm sure Carpenter kind of crafted, but I think Cundey has a lot to do with it, too. And that's why when you look at... He came back for Halloween 2 and 3, which Carpenter didn't do, but they still look in uniform with the first one.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious, Aaron, to know what you think of The Fog.
I like The Fog. It's not what I put in like my top Carpenter films. It's probably like it's in the top 10 somewhere. It's not in the top 5, but I think The Fog.
Hashtag oh, Aaron thinks The Fog is okay.
I.
That is not why I asked. By
we
the
just
way.
We get into this just over and over. I. The Fog, honestly, it's just not one that I've like watched as much as the other Carpenter films that
When's
I really
When's the last
really
time
admire.
You watched it? You should watch it again.
I watched it last year, actually.
That's not enough, clearly.
What's interesting, actually,
but
you
I
know,
think I think there's a legit creepiness to just the nature of The Fog, and then mm-hmm. the pirate ghosts. As humorous as it is for me to basically say pirate ghosts, it is an effective look for like a kind of a menacing force that isn't as, you know, I don't know, ubiquitous as single stalking threat like Michael Myers, but it's just like, well, what am I moving on to now? Well, there's a fog and it contains this in it. And like I enjoy the way that Carpenter, you know, he finds a way to kind of have this ensemble cast moving around this force that contains pirate ghosts. Like,
wait, is it pirate ghosts or ghost pirates, really? Because did we ever figure that out?
Egg. I don't know.
Potato, potato. Well, you know, what's interesting, I think I'm kind of with Jimmy on The Fog. You know, I really do like The Fog, but I think I can, you know, it seems like I think maybe why anybody who might, you know, might not think it's kind of in the same cachet was that when Halloween came out, I think maybe they were looking for The Fog to be, you know, on that level. And I think The mm-hmm. Fog is definitely more a creepy kind of, you know, tonally, a completely different film than Halloween, in that it's just going for like a creepy, sinister kind of story. And I think, and it's interesting because if you listen to the commentary, he talks about how when the studio got it, they were like, oh, there's got to be more scares and stuff. Because they were cashing in on
they had to go reshoot more scares.
Right. Yeah. They wanted to cash in on the John Carpenter Halloween thing, and I think he was going for something different with The Fog. So it's interesting that, not jumping to the next movie, but that his next movie would be completely out of that genre to go, you know what I mean? Because I think he didn't want to be I think maybe he felt with The Fog like they were pigeonholing him to kind of do that scary stuff that he does, and he was like, no, that's not what I do. I tell a story, whether it's got scares in it or not. So I like The Fog as a creepy movie and as an unsettling movie, and I agree, great, you know, some great performances. I like The Fog.
Well, I worked with I did a play with John Goff, who is the guy that gets killed, one of the fishermen, and he would tell me stories about how I think it was 6 months later he had to go in and get bloody for it, and it was just the weirdest experience to go back after that long and shoot those scenes.
This is an older idea, and I think it should be used more nowadays. They didn't make, like, sequels. They just, hey, let's get the team back together and just do a different scary movie rather than do Halloween 2. Let's get the team back, the same director, some of the cast, and that's what you do. That's what I think comedy sequels, we should have comedy sequels. We should have the collective get back together and do another funny movie.
Yeah, and you know, I've certainly talked about that many times. It's like, let's just get Bill Murray and the guys to do another thing, which is what they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We got to keep moving. We're less than halfway through this filmography, and the next one here, Escape from New York, is basically a collection of almost every Carpenter player. Looking at Carpenter films, this seems like this is like not. I'm not saying it's the best, but it seems like it could be like the ultimate John Carpenter movie, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
The hero of the film, the, you know, the anti-hero of the film, the casting, the pacing, the design, score. The score. Like, it seems like it has, it's a representation of everything that John Carpenter does in one movie.
Yeah, it's got that somber tone, which I think was maybe what made people apprehensive, because nobody had kind of seen it like that kind of dystopian kind of, you know, dark, but which is why, of course, years later they were like, oh, it's genius, but it was so raw and great, and Kurt Russell is so freaking amazing in that movie. What a great gamble that just paid off in spades, man. It's
and they wrote
awesome.
It they, him and Russell came up with it on the set of The Fog.
It's great.
Crazy enough.
What was Kurt Russell doing on the set of The Fog?
They were working on Escape from New York together. I have
Yeah, that book. Because they worked on Elvis, and he was kind of like, oh, just visiting him on set and stuff. So I think they had kind of kept in contact. I have those pictures in that book, too. It's great. It's a great,
must have.
Yeah, chronologically, you know, picture history of their work, of the stuff together. But
isn't it great to just think that Kurt Russell and John Carpenter just hang out sometimes, and we have no idea what's going on, but it's really awesome.
They play Xbox together.
Yeah, absolutely. They do.
One of the great pairings that brings out the best in both of their work.
Oh, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Although Russell's not his most used performer.
No, not nearly as much as you kind of think, actually.
Right. Peter Jason, who we'll meet on later on.
But Escape from New York. Any other general thoughts on Escape from New York?
Not a horror movie, but does contain horror elements.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the stuff I really like this film all the way through, but stuff I really like is kind of the setup of the world, like when the president lands and it's like, well, now where are we? And you have just like all this like weird stuff happening, like the one guy that gives the countdown when they're trying to figure out where the president is. It's like,
you can't make this movie now because the only things we learn about this world.
Romero, thank you. Yes.
The only things we need here in the movie is what happens to Snake Plissken. And nowadays we try to like build up other characters too much, focus on other things. Like, this is just Snake Plissken and whoever's comes into contact with Snake Plissken.
Yeah. Let's move on now to The Thing, which is a favorite movie of mine.
It's one of his most notable films that bombed hardest, like was roughest on him and not accepted, but now hands down praised.
I mean, it's one of, if not the greatest remake of all time. It has effects.
Definitely one of the top five.
It has effects that hold up to this day. Every time I watch this movie, every time the doctor sticks his hands down and suddenly the chest opens.
Makes me jump.
Just gets me every single time I watch that.
That spider head still, I mean, that was like one of my nightmares as a kid when I first saw that thing. I like that thing is crawling under my bed, I'm sure of it.
It's because that makeup is inspired. I mean, it's from someone's mind where Carpenter didn't vet it. He just said, give me some good stuff. Give me some original, unique stuff. And Boutin just opened his mind and did the most crazy, insane stuff you've ever seen. And it shows. It's amazing. And you go, oh, I've never seen anything like that. And that's sometimes giving maybe license to those makeup artists and those effects artists to create, you know, something in their mind. It pays off, and it did it. Huge in The Thing. It's awesome, man.
And just right from the beginning, it's just like you get the whole opening credits, and that title just burns onto screen, but just like
score,
in the original.
A score Carpenter didn't do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Ennio Morricone is like
Carpenter.
Ennio Morricone steps in, and it's like, hey, I'm gonna do this, and look how amazing it is. Like, it's just so simple.
Yeah,
much like many of his scores, but it's just so great and wonderful.
It contains one of the most suspenseful scenes I think I've ever seen, where they're doing the blood tests.
Oh yeah,
that is.
Oh yeah,
on the even to this day, I know where it's going, but I'm still just, is it going to pop out? Is it going to be? Yeah, it's
and
great.
It's interesting that you, Aaron, that you talked about Robert Rodriguez being an influence, because of course he used that scene sort of to a certain extent in The Faculty with the whole drug thing. So I was like, oh, that's right out of The Thing, man.
A movie I like quite a bit, by the way.
I like that.
Yeah.
I've read that Carpenter saved this movie in the editing room. Like, that it's not what he had originally set out to do was not the final product we ended up. Like, he came up with a new story within the editing room.
Wow.
Like, he went and reshot some stuff. He took a break, looked at what he had, put together. He's like, you know what? I think I can do this with it, and changed what he was doing. You can find a big, long article about that on the web. But
it's funny because I remember that movie came out around the same time as E.T., and that was kind of the thing that derailed the movie. But I can't even remember rewatching E.T. that much. But The Thing, I watch all the time. So it's interesting what movies you'll go back and revisit, even, you know, what's popular at that time. So, I mean, it kind of was like the anti-E.T., but...
Yeah. When it opened the same weekend as Blade Runner,
Wow.
Neither did
Will.
Neither did Will because
Spielberg was killing them.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to see evil aliens. They wanted to see E.T.
Cuddly aliens.
Yeah.
Not cundy aliens.
No, that's different.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, the thing, this probably, I mean, it goes back and forth between this and Halloween, but I love the thing. I think it's just fantastic.
It's just great.
The they're not even one liners, but just kind of the dialogue in this movie is just really, it's just very well done.
With an amazing cast, man. I mean,
David's terrific.
Oh, who's who of just fantastic actors.
All right. Next up, we have Christine.
You can't talk about Christine without talking about how utterly amazing and still holding up the car rebuilding itself is. That is the most visually amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I remember showing that to my kid, you know, who's, you know, he's all tainted on CGI and stuff, and even he saw that and went, wow. It looks, it holds up, man.
There's stuff like that in a couple John Carpenter movies where I look at the effects and think, I don't offhand, like, I'm pretty good at knowing how stuff gets done just based off looking at all these behind the scenes features and whatnot. And what some of his movies, there are times where I'm like, you know, I don't inherently know how this was done, and I'm very okay with that. I like that it just, like, it just works for me.
Well, it's nice because you get to disappear into the movie and you get to just, you know, let it happen. And you're not trying to, okay, well, yeah, they did this or they did that. It's a lot more fun. Yeah. These early movies that, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, Carpenter made the best Stephen King Evil Greasers movie there is with Christine.
Wait, now you're forgetting Sometimes They Come Back Again.
As much as I love Robert Ressler,
that's great. And again, his use of anything to make menace, you know, like music, like that the scene where Moochie comes underneath the underpass, and you just hear that little itty bitty pretty one, that song, just that the hint of that, it's menace, it's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good use of music in that movie.
Try to keep these tight. So let's move on.
Well, we mentioned that Wes got Meryl an Oscar nomination last week, and we were like, oh, well, who else did that? And we're like, but didn't John Carpenter get Jeff Bridges one for Starman?
Jeff Bridges. He didn't win, but he was nominated.
He was nominated. But Meryl didn't win either.
And that was an interesting, Starman was an interesting foray into kind of a little more supernatural, a little more sweet sentimentality in that movie.
Well, it's funny because he's following up the thing, which was killed by good aliens. So now he has, well, Starman, here we go.
It's his second highest grossing film.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Starman is a great movie. Starman is a terrific film.
I really like it as a movie where I feel for Karen Allen. Like, I think...
Oh, yeah.
Like, the way it tells the story where she is a widow, and just kind of how Jeff Bridges, how that relationship grows based off of what you're seeing from her perspective, I think is very just well done in a way that Carpenter just doesn't do very often. Like you mentioned Sentimental already, and that's very much the case here.
Yeah. Well, and
it's a beautiful story.
It is. And the other notable thing about Starman was that it was the one time that three of the special effects makeup greats came together and did a scene. Now they cut the crap out of the sequence, but it was Dick Smith, the legendary Dick Smith, the late Stan Winston, and Rick Baker all worked on that film together.
Which I recall you had a key question to ask.
I did. I was asking him, you know, is there ever going to be a special edition where you kind of put even if it's not, doesn't fit, show us that sequence in its entirety. And he said, nope. He said, I put out the movie I wanted to put out and that's it. So you'll never see a special edition with any extra footage from that stuff. But that is the movie where all three of them, you know, actually work together.
Charles Martin Smith's also quite good in Starman. I like him.
That's a great, you know,
he sometimes annoys me. That's why I need to bring it out.
Carpenter was all of these films have really strong casts. I mean, he got really, really good actors.
He didn't like to work with big names. Like, I mean, some of these are names, but he didn't like to work with stars. Like, he one thing Carpenter says he doesn't like to work with stars. He liked people on the level of like a Kurt Russell. But he doesn't like to work with big names.
I just realize, by the way, that by having Karen Allen, it's like he's trying to stick it to Spielberg, where he's like, all right, well, I got your star from Raiders of the Lost Ark in a movie, friendly alien movie. So let's see how this goes.
Nice.
I'd like to think that that's what Carpenter thinks. He just kind of wants to stick it to Spielberg. Like that's his goal in some of these movies.
It probably was. I would almost guarantee that.
It's like, oh yeah, you're going to be a big studio guy with all these big budget movies and movie stars. Well, how about this? All right, now let's move on to Big Trouble Little China.
I mean, the greatest movie risk ever, because literally that movie is very hard to give a single categorization to. It's all over the place, but wonderfully all over the place. And that's why, you know, when I heard rumblings of The Rock wanting to do a remake, I just thought, well, that's odd, because I don't even think that movie is so beyond any categorization. It's brilliant. So I was like, I don't know how they're going to capture that. I think only somebody as inspired as John Carpenter could have made that movie.
Yeah, it's hard to, like, I wouldn't. Yeah, it's a movie, like, I don't need a remake of Big Trouble Little China. That said,
if
they're doing something like that, I'm just more curious about who else they cast, since The Rock would, you know, not be the hero of that movie. He'd just happen to be the biggest star in it, much like Kurt Russell is the biggest star in Big Trouble Little China. They're both inherently likable, so that, you know, helps right there. But let's not even get into that. Let's just talk about the movie that exists right now. Like,
I swear it inspired Mortal Kombat.
Sure, absolutely. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
But no, it's a fun movie. There's really nothing like it, and you know Russell knows exactly what he's doing.
A John Wayne impression.
It's one of Kim Cattrall's best efforts.
And Dennis Dunn is essentially the lead of the movie, you know.
He's the hero of the story,
right? And I remember him saying, in one of the commentaries, him saying, you know, that the studio was like, well, wait a minute, Russell isn't the hero of the movie, like, but the fact that he would go to that place with Carpenter, I think, is just it's a gamble that pays, man.
And while I've talked about how it's more just dialogue I appreciate in The Thing, this movie is chock full of one-liners. Like, everything Jack Burton said. Jack Burton?
Yeah.
Like, everything he says in this movie. I feel great. I feel kind of invincible. Like, just every single thing he's doing is just wonderful. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting to see a movie like this, which is kind of this, like, larger-than-life action comedy from Carpenter, who's a guy that doesn't make, like, super fast-paced, quick-cutting movies. So, like, you certainly, like, somehow his style still registers here.
Yeah.
You get the sense of the world building, which is like we talked about in the other films, because you know you're basically in Chinatown the whole time, and it's filled with mystical people all of a sudden, and it is unclassifiable, Brandon. You're right. Like, there's just like it's combining so many different things into one like hodgepodge crazy movie. You don't really know what to call it except entertaining. Like, it is very entertaining.
Movie not accepted during its time.
And it even ends on like the strange. Like, it doesn't, like, the ending makes like all, it's like so like it's like a, it's almost like a, it's like a down note essentially. It's like what just, like, everything seemed to work out well, yet we're like kind of like, well, I'm leaving. Like, and then like weird like Baron Samedi callback because things on the side of the truck or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's amazing how, like, so many of John Carpenter's films just, we keep talking about them, and it's like, oh yeah, when it came out, no one cared. And now everyone cares. Now everyone loves it.
Because I think we grew up, like,
another
VHS.
One of those movies.
A lot of, like, my generation grew up watching them on VHS, where there are these little discoveries, and they're, like, awesome. And it was a surprise when the internet came out to find out that they weren't successful movies or anything else, but we were always talking about these when I was younger.
Well, now we move over to The Prince of Darkness. Which we already discussed a little bit.
Woo-hoo!
This is another movie that feels like the kind of like the epitome of what John Carpenter can do to make a movie that's not going to like catch on with mainstream audiences. Like,
but again, this was during that period, during that Shep Gordon period of live films over at Universal, and where they were kind of giving the directors carte blanche to really create something interesting and original. And that Prince of Darkness is right out of that.
And I think much ahead of its time.
It very much is. Like, I can easily see.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, I'm surprised there's no remake announcement for a film like this. I'd obviously be much different, but just kind of the overarching like themes of this movie, the way it kind of it tells the story of basically the world coming to an end and like a scientific look at that, which is really interesting.
and
also Alice Cooper. But
homeless Alice Cooper.
But you know, this movie, like, oh man, there's so much scary, creepy imagery in here. Like the VHS, like of the thing walking through the door, and so that still creeps me out.
Oh, I had nightmares about that for weeks, man.
Yeah, man, yeah. It's still scary, and it just. The way, yeah, the Alice
that
Cooper
whisper,
stuff is...
that voice, that the yeah. scene with a bike. This is, I mean, you know, he.
I've got a message, and you're not going to like it. Yes, yes.
Yeah. It's, so creepy, and it's the second part. Wow. It's a thematic sequel to The Thing.
Is what it is. It's the part of his apocalypse trilogy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get to the other part later on in a sec, but let's move on to the next film, They Live, which.
This could be another one like Escape from New York is like the, you know, all Carpenter, like stereotypical Carpenter type thing.
It has a lot mm-hmm. of those elements, but and it's also heavy on the satire, which works.
Oh yeah,
which works really well. Like even with you know, I wonder was there ever a thought of getting Kurt Russell in this movie?
It feels like it could have been a project for him, but I think he did write it for Roddy Piper because he left a lot of the dialogue empty in hopes and. Let Piper take his wrestling one-liner book and fill out dialogue with it. So I think while it feels like Russell could easily fit into this movie, I think he wanted Piper.
See, I think Piper is a much better... Russell's great, but I think what I liked about Piper was that even though, you know, he had the great one-liners and the wrestling and the fighting for 10 pages or whatever it was, there was an everyman quality to Roddy Piper in that movie.
As homeless drifter.
Yeah. So, I mean, he was supposed to be sort of the staple for these people who were all downtrodden, who were getting crapped on, who, you know, who were getting, you know, railroaded by a system that was, you know, giving money to the rich and making sure the poor would stay down. So I it always, to me, was very relatable that he was in that role.
He has a presence that makes this one more unique than some of the others that
I can see that, especially with the kind of the tone of this movie. It feels different from a Carpenter movie, and I think something about the harmonica score is part of that. But
go ahead.
It has something to it where I, you know, the satire obviously, but it has like an element to it where it's like it's sci-fi, I guess, but it it's very much a Carpenter film, but it just like the way it progresses, the way you kind of follow along with Roddy Piper's character, it has a vibe that keeps it both a Carpenter film and something all of its own, which is part of why I like it a lot too. Like it's telling you the story of aliens that have secretly taken over.
It's something like, big happening with a really intimate story.
Exactly, and it
has a long fight
one
scene.
Film that I didn't. I oh geez, that this fight scene is so iconic. What was? Did they make fun of this in South Park?
South Park recreates this fight scene with
yes,
Jimmy put on
Jimmy,
the hat.
Jimmy and Timmy. Like,
brilliant. Me and Jason tried to do it one time. It was really fun.
Yeah, we only got to the second page. Yeah, he won.
Yeah, it was
of 19 pages.
I won. Yes,
it's a long fight.
Fight continues.
So what happens between next up we have Memoirs of the Invisible Man,
and Chevy Chase, Daryl Hannah, effects,
and then Body Bags.
Warner Brothers. What?
And then Body Bags eventually, but like, what's going on with Carpenter at this time? Like, what? Because this is like his longest break. Like, and this is kind
it does
of,
seem
and this
like
is the end
just...
of. This is really the end of like his great. I mean, we'll get to In the Mouth of Madness, which I think has its moments. But
I'd be curious to know if Carpenter was asked on that movie, Memoirs of Invisible Man. Like, if maybe Chevy Chase was already attached to it, and they sort of said, "Well, what director would you like to see do it?"
Well, it was Ivan Reitman.
Ivan
Reitman and Chevy Chase, and then they got in a spat, and Reitman left the project, and somehow Carpenter wound up on it.
Interesting.
Well, someone fought with Chevy Chase? Really? Never expect that.
Yeah. I think Memoirs was in a little bit of development hell for a while, too, with Carpenter attached, and that may have taken a year or two extra.
I have nothing to say, really, about Memoirs of an Invisible Man, so it's
not a great film.
Yeah, no.
The invisible effects are awesome. I think they still hold up. Oh, the rain scene where it's in the rain, where they tried to something recently tried to do it the same, but there's the effects hold are pretty impressive.
Memoirs to me feels a little bit like Craven doing Vampire in Brooklyn, you know, where you just
it was freaking Daredevil tried to do that with The Rain.
But the
Affleck one, not the TV show. But no, the Chevy Chase one, that one thing I will give it is the effects are still pretty awesome.
Any other thoughts on Body Bags? We kind of talked about it a little bit last week with Wes Craven.
That's all right. I mean, it's not the most memorable of. I mean, it definitely has its fans.
It's neat to see Carpenter having fun acting.
I'm not necessarily a huge fan of it. It was okay.
Now wait. Yes, He did Hair, right? The gas station was fun, but Hair, I like Hair. The one with Stacey Keach. I'm definitely a fan of that one. Again, good use of music. You know, he used a great piece of music in that, and Stacey Keach has got kind of a great tone in that one. I like that. I like that
one. That one, the gas station one, are good. Those are the ones Carpenter did. The one Hooper did goes a little. Just the Mark Hamill one just goes a little. Like, I never asked to see Mark Hamill's butt, but I got it, and that one just goes a little too creepy.
That's funny. I don't even remember.
Yeah, it's the eye one where he's the ball player that gets in a wreck and gets like the murderer's eye.
Right. I don't remember seeing his butt.
Yeah, it's in there, but I think. But in the in betweens with Carpenter as the little dead body. I mean, it's nice to see him having fun with that. I kind of like.
Well, now we get to In the Mouth of Madness, and. Which people that only know Event Horizon for Sam Neill being crazy, they need to see this movie if they want to know what Sam Neill looks crazy like.
Possession.
Possession, another good one, yeah. What's neat about In the Mouth of Madness to me is that it certainly brings Carpenter into the 90s. Like, this looks like a 90s movie. It doesn't feel like a classic 80s John Carpenter movie. And I honestly think that takes away from some of what he's really good at. Like, I don't know what it is exactly, but it seems like it's missing a certain it's missing something that I appreciate about Carpenter films. You guys have any idea what I'm talking about in this studio?
I can see that in the aesthetic, but I think it holds on strong. I really like this movie quite a bit.
Yeah, there's a weirdness, you know, we were talking about Craven with Serpent and the Rainbow. There's a weirdness in the Mouth of Madness that I see what you're saying about the Carpenter kind of staple, but there's an oddness and a kind of a weird tone and vibe to In the Mouth of Madness that I always kind of dug.
Yeah.
It's kind of like maybe he's evolving in his filmmaking, but then he'll take steps back in the next movie.
We'll get there, but I mean, because this is the final film in the Apocalypse trilogy, and it's my least favorite of it. Like, I appreciate the kind of, like, I'm going to do something Lovecraftian here. I'm going to go wild of kind of this weird town with I don't know what going on, like the way he kind of jumps into madness for this movie. It's neat, but just beyond Sam Neill's general exasperation for not knowing what the hell's going on, which always entertains me in horror movies, there's not much here that does it for me.
It's a weird movie, and it's one that depending on my mood is whether I like it or not. I think I've seen it like 3 or 4 times, and it's one of those that, I don't know, it doesn't always connect, but once in a while I'll be in the mood for it. I'll be like, yeah, okay.
It's maybe a little more psychological than normal for Carpenter. He'll be a lot more effect-worthy with his creepiness, and this one goes more psychological and a bit dry on, like, gore and stuff like that.
All right, so now... So this last set of films...
He goes for a remake again.
Village of the Damned, I had heard this was so bad that I had skipped it, and I finally saw it one day, like a few years back. I was like, I didn't hate it. I really didn't hate it. It has moments, though. It's not his best, but it's certainly not as, I like this better than Vampires.
It looks and feels like a John Carpenter film.
Yes, absolutely.
I think the cool stuff is how he makes those kids look so 1940s or whatnot.
Yeah.
While being in that film. But
out of all of these last few films, that's probably the one I can deal with the most.
Terribly acted. I mean, was it Kirstie Alley and Christopher Reeve?
Christopher Reeve's last film, Walking.
Yep.
Yeah, it's really bad.
it's I can't get on. For me, it might be his worst.
Yeah, I don't think it's his worst. I don't think it's his worst, but I think Escape from LA and you know, Ghosts of Mars maybe is worse.
Let's talk about Escape from LA, because I like, okay.
You know, and by the way, you know what pissed me off most about Escape from LA was they were saying, okay, we waited all this time to revisit Snake Plissken and we want to do it right. And essentially what they did is they took that first movie and they just repeated it. So you got every character there is just a different character. So the cabbie character is Steve Buscemi. The brain character is Pam Grier. And I was like, what are you guys doing? You just said, like, you took all this time to write an original tale for Snake Plissken and you just did all the tropes of the first movie and did none of the good stuff of it. And also, the second thing, just real quick, why is Snake Plissken was an anti-hero asshole who was just bitter, angry, and had a gun. He doesn't have the skills to do all this stuff, so they're having him play basketball, surfing. I'm like, what the hell is this?
Snake Plissken's a guy who's bitter
and angry, and that's it. Like, what the hell are we doing? It's a ridiculous film, and I'm a huge Snake Plissken fan.
Yeah, well, you're only apparently 50% Snake Plissken fan.
Yeah,
right? Yeah. This didn't feel like Snake Plissken. This felt like a parody of Snake Plissken,
which is weirdly, which is
ridiculous. I mean, the '90s like to take old things and make them look cool and new, and they did it to Snake Plissken with a ridiculous leather coat and outfit. And it's just
Jesus.
And I went and saw. I mean, I remember opening weekend going. I was so excited. I was like, wait, I've seen this shit before.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Weirdly, yeah. Roger Ebert 3.5 stars for this movie.
Wow.
out of 4.
Wow.
He was in a good mood.
During Roger's easygoing phase, you know.
Yeah, he got much nicer the later on in his career.
Well, because there was all these celebrity interviews and stuff. He's trying to kiss a little ass. Yeah, forget all that, man.
Yeah, it's the movie, I don't know. I mean, there's stuff that's okay. I like the beefed up score was kind of exciting. It's like, oh yeah, and you know, you get Stacey Keach in there, Michelle Forbes, but
you got that trailer shot where, like, what does he do? He's like, I'm gonna throw this up in the air, when it lands we'll draw or whatever, and he just shoots ball when it's all in the air. Like, he does a couple Snake Plissken-y things in this movie.
Yes. Well, I actually thought the basketball scene was funny because I don't think they're trying to say Snake Plissken's good at basketball.
But he won. I mean, he threw the ball. Like, I was like, what is this? He doesn't play basketball, dude.
How do you know?
Ridiculous.
Stupid.
How do you know?
Do you really think Snake Plissken?
He doesn't play basketball.
He's already said, and of course, Kurt Russell's already said in interviews, this is a guy who doesn't care about anything. He cares about nothing. He cares
except the United Team sport of basketball.
Yeah.
In the original opening of Escape from LA, they're like planning this bank or Escape from New York. They're planning that bank heist, and before that, there's a deleted written scene about them playing basketball.
Yeah.
Well, the guy who got killed at the beginning of that opening scene they cut was that was his point guard from
Exactly. For some reason, Escape from LA comes on randomly on TV, and whenever I catch it, it always happens to be at that damn basketball scene. Which is, like, it's pretty close to the surfing scene, by the way, so I kind of stick with it and then get to that.
And is it a surf?
And then I get to Steve Buscemi's bug eyes, is like, what? This is happening? And then I turn the channel. Like, I'm done.
Oh, jeez.
It's just it's a miss.
Yeah.
All right, what's next on this? Is it vampires?
Weren't you hoping vampires?
With America's favorite Republican, James Woods.
But weren't you hoping
in our favorite Baldwin, the
mesh of those two, that Carpenter and Woods would make a good? You were like, oh, this could be good. And it was just like,
so disappointing. So disappointing. I really did not like this film.
It almost felt like there was not enough. It almost felt like there was no script. Like, almost like James Woods was just riffing. Because, you know, listen, there's some great James Woods performances out there, but maybe they've been scripted. Because in this, it felt like he was just riffing, like saying the F word every 5 seconds. And I was like, if you reel him in, he'll give you gold, man. And it just felt like it was a disaster.
You know, Carpenter might have been going for maybe thinking that Woods would give him what Kurt Russell and Roddy Piper had given him before. And Woods maybe just wasn't that type of performer.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I was okay with Vampire. I don't think it's nowhere near. It's on his bottom half, but it might be a little bit more towards the top bottom, like, four for me.
Hmm.
I honestly really hate this movie.
I really, you know what?
This might be my bottom.
I really, because this was a, you know, I discovered Cheryl Lee and I loved her and I was excited because James Wood, Cheryl Lee, and I was just sitting there watching it and she was just treated, it was such a just misogynistic, just awful.
Everybody's totally wasted in that movie.
Oh, just painful. Just painful. Got 6 point. Money. Yeah, it did. It did. Yeah. And I know a lot of people that really like this movie. Ugh. Like really like
it has a sequel, doesn't it? Like what's it?
Has a couple,
Los Muertos with Bon Jovi.
With Bon Jovi, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder what's better, From Dusk Till Dawn to Texas Blood Money or Vampires to Los Muertos.
The From Dusk Till Dawn sequels are kind of entertaining.
Yeah.
Wow. There's more Bruce Campbell, and you can't.
You know what, dude? You're living on a prayer.
Shut up.
See what I did there?
Oh, Jimmy, you were halfway there.
Okay. Moving on to Ghosts of Mars.
I just wanted Dead or Alive, man.
Ghosts of Mars, which was Escape from Mars.
Yeah, yeah. It's essentially, yeah, it's Escape from New York.
Ice Mars. Cube was supposed to be Snake Plissken.
Yeah, and you're like, well, no.
But, I mean, Ice Cube has replaced Vin Diesel, so, I mean, he's clearly an all-purpose actor.
But it was the Carpenter cast Statham in that role, and the studio forced Ice Cube to take it. So he had to swap Statham to
it. Wow, I did not know this.
Because of marketing power.
Wow. Oh, my God.
And you get Natasha Henstridge, who was hot off of Species.
Yeah, yeah. She was
hot off of Species too,
and he reunited with Pam Grier.
Yeah, that Escape from LA.
Because their last collaboration was a great movie.
Yeah.
Well, he served her well because I believe he leaves her decapitated head on a stick at some point in this movie.
Right. this movie, oh.
Admittedly, I've actually never seen this movie. I was so jaded with vampires, I did not watch this film.
You've seen Escape from New York. You're missing nothing.
Okay. Yeah. Well, how can
completely? It... It's completely again uninspired. I hate to use that word, but
what a great cast too. What?
It does have a fun cast, like Ice Cube, Natasha Hendricks, Jason Statham, Clay Duvall, Pam Grier,
yeah,
Joanna
Cassidy.
Like,
yeah, this is a good cast.
Do you think maybe he didn't care at that point? Maybe.
I think Carpenter realized he was out of gas after this run of movies, because I mean he doesn't make another one for 9 years, and now he's just like, yeah, I have nothing, you know, it's hot to get me to make a film. He was just done. He was just tired, and you can
honestly
see it.
The best thing he did in this whole, you know, for after They Live was probably the Masters of Horror, the cigarette burns. I like that. I actually enjoyed that. I thought it was kind of original and kind of unique.
I haven't seen The Ward. I have not heard good things about The Ward.
I have seen The Ward, and it is.
It's just mediocre city.
It's awful, man.
Yeah,
it
didn't look good. I mean, I love Amber Heard, and I haven't even
seen
it.
All the boys love Mandy Lane. Fantastic
they
film.
Do.
But
they
holy,
do love
holy crap is, yeah. The Ward is like, he doesn't care anymore, man. He doesn't want to make movies. And you know what? I don't think he's really made any concessions about that. He sort of said, I've done my movies. I really don't care anymore. So I almost am wondering why he wanted to direct that movie. Because if he didn't love the story or wasn't impassioned by it, it just sort of seems like a paycheck. And I kind of got the sense from John the last time I saw him, because he was being honored at one of the festivals, that he was just like, I'm done. I don't really want to make movies anymore. I don't care.
He admittedly does play video games, so maybe he just needed to get that Xbox money. I mean, there's
there you go.
It's
there
bad
go.
Though. It's there's nothing interesting about The Ward.
No, it's a movie that's been done over and over and over again, and now it's just John Carpenter doing it, but putting no personal stamp on it.
No signature style, no nothing. I think I could probably show you The Ward, Aaron, and if you didn't know, and you might not know it was John Carpenter, you might go, who did this?
I feel like listeners are going to miss the first half of this podcast where we talked about all the great things that John Carpenter did in his career.
Well, as I said, you got the further back you go, the better the movies get.
Yeah, well, so let's bring it back around here to just kind of some more recap our overall thoughts in some way, I guess, that's, you know, slightly different from when we started, because, you know, we've gone quite long now, but you know, when the stuff was good, it was really good. And Brandon, you mentioned this already, like that run of films that he had up until They Live is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Like this, I mean, even the lesser ones within there are still, you know, very good. Like it's certainly very, very watchable, which is fun to say, given that his films are generally, you know, they're not like slick. They're not slick and hype, half, you know, fast paced. They're very deliberately made films from a filmmaker who kind of really likes to represent an older style of filmmaking mixed with his personal touches, and that shows really well in this collection of films that he has.
I mean, when since he, I mean, since he hasn't made a film, you know, in such a long time, his latter part and failures have been, you know, pretty much forgotten because those films were forgettable. So it gets to just focus on the good things he did. And he's not, I mean, he's not constantly making films to be in our public conscious of that. And, you know, when, you know, the time comes and he passes, no one's going to talk about the failures. It's going to be such a highlight fest. It's going to be ridiculous.
Because there's definitely more.
It's way more. It's just the poor ones came at the end. That's it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Here's a question.
He had Michael Jordan for the Wizards seasons at the end. Like that was no one's going to talk about him.
If any of these could be remade, if any of these, like aside from Halloween, if you could see a sequel to any of these, which would you want to see a sequel to?
Let's do a sequel.
Let's not do remake. Let's do a sequel.
Well, if Kurt Russell and him want to get back together for another escape movie, like I'd want a good version of that.
See, not me. They would mess that up. I would go. They already did it.
What kind of imagined scenario is this? Well, we're imagining our dream version of what movie he would do next, yet he still doesn't care for some reason.
Yeah, right. Big Trouble in Little China. In the dream, you know what? Because he can make that as weird as possible, and you still would at least think it was original and interesting.
But in the dream hypothetical world that Jimmy's presenting, I like to think that he's firing on all cylinders. So I want to see a better Snake Plissken movie.
Gotcha. I would want to see Prince of Darkness. I'd want to see another one because I love that it ended in such a weird, creepy way. I'd love to see that.
I love
the Carpenter endings. That's why I love it too. And as much as I love the Halloween series, how much better is it if Halloween never had a sequel?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And Michael Myers, I think that film would be.
I love the sequel. Dude. Touted higher. I love Halloween two, but Halloween one without it would have been perfection, and it still is.
And it'd be touted a lot higher than it is because, not only did it have so many sequels, it also inspired a lot of films that got people. It created a fad that people got really tired of and didn't. All the movies got bashed, so then I think Halloween's praise goes down a little when it comes to like all time horror movies,
mm-hmm. which is a shame.
But it could be higher, I think.
Yeah, it's a shame too because it's still I got my tickets, man. 29th, I'm going. Big screen.
Halloween, nice.
Yeah. I mean, I still love that movie. Yeah, no, Halloween through Fathom Events is coming back to the theaters on the 29th.
The annoying thing about that is I don't like watching Halloween in theaters anymore because I don't like
the audience is too much of a gamble.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, I had a
like if I'm going
issue.
To like the New Beverly, sure, like that'll probably work. But
I had one audience one year that they're so awful and they're just this like just awful kind of hipster crowd who just was like so. Yes, exactly. But every other time has been great. And it's a yearly thing. I take my son every year, so it's it's gotten better. It was the first year we went, the audience was just awful, but it is getting better. I remember seeing The Exorcist having the same reaction. People were laughing through the whole movie. I was like, shut up.
Hey, Aaron, weren't we at that Carpenter thing together, weren't we?
Yes, we were.
Oh yeah, that's funny. And I remember, and it was funny. It had nothing to do with his films, except for the character. But I remember they did it was a Gangnam style thing, but it was David Lopan style. And I goes to admit, I thought that was a hoot, man. So definitely great. Big Trouble Little China for me for a sequel. I think that there's so much opportunity to do crazy, insane, awesome stuff. And still be good. So you could hedge your bets by going, with Escape from LA or Escape from New York, say sequel. There's things that could go wrong. I think that if there's things that could go wrong, Big Trouble in China could only add to the movie. So I'd love to see a sequel to Big Trouble in Little China.
There you go.
Well, with that in mind, I think we should wrap it up because we've been trying to keep these tighter.
So much for that today.
good work. Body of work.
Hashtag
Aaron wants it tighter.
Well, we'll see. It should go a little smoother next week because there's a little less films in the way for our next filmmaker. We're going to be talking about Guillermo del Toro, which I think that'll be a fun entry to get into.
Oh, yeah. Can't wait.
Yeah. And I believe at least Jimmy and I will probably have seen Crimson Peak at that point by the time we record that episode. So,
yeah. Are you going Tuesday?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we'll have some insight on his latest in the realm of horror. But for now, let's leave it here and let's go over, you know, some quick plugs from you guys. Brandon, where can people find more of your work online?
Listen to my new podcast, Cult Cinema Cavalcade, which is at cultcinemacavalcade.com and on iTunes. And I'm on Twitter at BT Peters.
Jason Colvin.
You can see, you can check me out on starpulse.com. Of course, I do the Forgotten Friday flick every Friday. And you can check out on Facebook. Jimmy and I do flicks for fans. We do special events and stuff. And you can check that out at facebook.com/flicks, FOR, for fans.
Jimmy-o.
And yes, I'm at joblow.com and arrowinthehead.com. And I am, you know, all the typical Periscope, Facebook, Instagram.
Are you Periscoping often?
I do not do it that much, but, you know, it is what it is. And you can, you know, it's more for my ghost stuff. I've been doing a lot of ghost stuff and fitness stuff. So that's kind of what I put in Periscope. So there you go. You can enjoy that.
You can find me writing about movies daily on RantHollywood.com. You can follow me on Twitter at AaronsPS4. And, yeah, you have this Out Now Baron and Abe podcast. You can find on iTunes, Audio Boom. You have our Facebook page, Facebook.com/OutNowPodcast. Our Twitter, OutNow_podcast. And pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts, you can look up our show and like, take a listen. Thank you guys for joining me today to discuss John Carpenter.
It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will be back next week with another bonus horror ep focused on Guillermo del Toro, as I said. So until next time, that's going to do it. So long and goodbye.
Hashtag bonus horror.
It's cold outside. I've been running for miles. Helicopter trailing behind. Hey, it's a camp thing, I'll stay for a while. Won't you help a doggy out of a bind? There's nothing to see here, I'm only a husky, your average adorable rover. But once I convince you it's okay to trust me, your civilization is over. I can't wait to see their faces when I spring. Yes, sir, 'cause they think that I'm a dog. But I'm the thing, baby. Can you tell that I'm not from around here? Did you know that things are worse than you feared? 'Cause I've been to a million planets and I can copy you right down to your beard. You can check on your ancient computer. It's astonishing how quickly I spread. You can pick up an axe and go crazy, but I can grow legs from my head. So I might be MacReady, or maybe I'm Doc. Blair's been acting awfully suspicious. That Gary's a liar, be sure to watch Clark. And Windows, well, he's just delicious. So perform your little test. Hey, you found me, I'm impressed. Hate to interrupt your endless bickering. Big surprise, guys, I'm not another world, baby. Oh, you really gotta love paranoia. More than half of you believe that I'm Mac. Once you make up your mind, you can blow me up, or you can burn me, I'll keep coming back. I could be anyone, so watch those hands, Doc, ouch. You'll either end up dead or tied to this fucking couch. We're well past the point of silly denials. So am I MacReady or could I be Childs? Which one am I, baby? These poor bastards in the snow, they were clueless, now they know. It's a special brand of nightmare that I bring. Yes, they thought I was a dog, but I'm the thing.
Hey, Lonnie, get away from there.
Get your ass away from that house.
Let's just
do Donald Pleasance lines.
The darkest eyes. The devil's eyes.
He's gone! He's gone from here!
Evil is gone!
All right. That's plenty of that. Yeah, so I've got the crew.
He was doing really well last night.
Driving.
maybe someone around here gave him lessons.
Looking at a wall, not looking at a wall.
Looking past the wall, beyond the wall. All right, that's enough. That's enough of it. Stop it.
Looking at this podcast.
Okay, that's enough of that. We're talking about John Carpenter, damn it. That's the plan here.